The Wellness Way presents Barbara O'Neill. Barbara is coming to talk in London June the 11th, 2024. Go to phillyjlay.com to secure your tickets now. We'll see you there.
I mean, there's no question. No one has ever questioned the science. So I go to Alzheimer's Society. I go to Alzheimer's Research UK, whose banner is We Exist for a Cure, right? I go to Dementia UK and Alzheimer's Society, they say, we don't do prevention.
We don't do prevention.
Yeah, yeah. Just recently, front page newspapers have said £10 million trial funded by who? Bill Gates, Alzheimer's Research UK, and many of the People's Lottery. So the people out there gave their money to fund this trial, which involves 5,000 people being tested for a blood test called p-tau. Now, we know p-tau is, you get these neurofibrillary tangles. I mean, they're selecting people who think they've got a memory problem. They're testing p-tau, and they're going to tell you a few years later, guess what? People with memory problems have a high level of p-tau. Why are they doing this? It's the same as cholesterol and statins. Because they'll say, now...
We've got a drug!
You know? Yep. And there isn't a single independent study, i.e. not funded by the drug company. So I say, I'm the jack of all trades, the master of none. But when you put all the pieces together, suddenly this magic appears, which is you really can upgrade your brain. You absolutely do not need to ever go in the direction of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Welcome to The Wellness Way with me, Philly J. Lay, a layperson's guide to your natural health systems, your very own NHS. We know about Big Pharma, we know about Big Farming, but did you know about Big Shoe, who put fashion before fitness and wealth before well-being? Welcome to The Wellness Way. I'd like to introduce you to our sponsor, Vivo Barefoot. Embrace your human nature and reconnect to the natural world. Get 15% off your first Vivo Barefoot order using the code PJL15. If you'd like to know more about this, please go and check out my podcast episode with seventh generation cobbler, Galahad Clark, CEO of Vivo Barefoot. Thank you, Vivo Barefoot. Enjoy the rest of the show. Hello, lovely people, and welcome to another episode of The Wellness Way. And today is a day that I think a lot of us will feel quite emotional about. I know that I do. It is Alzheimer's Prevention Day, you know, and having known people with Alzheimer's, having watched my mother with dementia, I've invited on the show today a wonderful friend of the show, a wonderful man. He is a citizen scientist, author of 47 books, including this new one, Upgrade Your Brain, the truly remarkable scientist, Patrick Holford. Patrick, welcome back onto the show. And congratulations, first of all, on this. This is just tremendous work that you do. And it's not kind of recognised as much as it should be. And this really annoys me. So,
well, what's quite interesting on that front, actually, is that, one of the reasons this book is so special is that I've been working with maybe 14 of the world's leading experts, professors, all in one piece, like one's the omega-3 man, the other's the sugar daddy, and someone else is the B vitamins. And they're geniuses. I mean, these are people who've published hundreds of papers. You know, many Nobel Prizes should be in that collection. But of course, they've so focused on one thing, they don't see the other piece and the other piece and the other piece. So I say, I'm the jack of all trades, the master of none. But when you put all the pieces together, suddenly this magic appears. Which is you really can upgrade your brain. You absolutely do not need to ever go in the direction of dementia and Alzheimer's if you know what to do.
Well, Alzheimer's is now being called type 3 diabetes.
Part of the story.
Yeah. We know that it is preventable,
largely
preventable.
Well, let's just sort of unpack that sort of issue. Like, number one, we hear about like 1 in 5 people are getting dementia and 2/3 of dementia is Alzheimer's. It's a disease. You scan the brain. So you diagnose dementia on the basis of a cognitive function test where your cognitive function, your memory, your ability to work things out has decreased. But you can only diagnose Alzheimer's with a brain scan of the central area of the brain developed by some of my scientists in the group originally at Oxford University, which is used worldwide. So you have to have a scan. So it's a disease, like diabetes is a disease. It's not a natural consequence of the aging process. You know, the whole point is if one in five get it, four in five don't. So it's obviously, you know, 100% preventable for those four in five. Mm. And the question is, what about the one in five? So that's kind of how that works. Now, there are causative genes. They're very rare. They're called presenilin and AP, or amyloid protein precursor. And they account for less than one in 100 cases. So we could really say that 99 cases out of 100 are potentially preventable. And theoretically, we could say that, you know, literally 99% of cases can be prevented if people do the right things early enough. Now, if you actually look at what you could absolutely say the science shows, it's around 80%. But we'll talk about that, because actually we're underestimating prevention, always underestimating. And I'll explain why when we go into different areas. So that's kind of it. Now, the youngest age of an Alzheimer's, a non-genetic Alzheimer's diagnosis is 19.
I find that quite shocking. And you told me a statistic earlier that the cognitive decline starts going down at really a very young age, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, what we did back in 2010, when the genius Professor David Smith and Helga Refsen, professor from Oslo, did the seminal study. I mean, these were the guys who were involved in developing the original brain scan. You know, they're like the leaders.
Yeah.
You know, they know exactly what they died. They kind of defined what Alzheimer's was through the brain scan process. What they did was they gave one group placebos, one group B vitamins, high dose, B12, B6, folate, and they got 53% less brain shrinkage, which is extraordinary. I mean, the latest drugs, lecanemab, got 20% increased brain shrinkage in 1 year, right? So we're talking about 53% less shrinkage, right? And not only that, in the lecanemab drug, there wasn't a single person who got better. They just got a little bit less worse, apparently, than the placebo group. In this, 30% ended the year with no clinical dementia rating. No, they would no longer be diagnosed with dementia or pre-dementia. Gone. Finished. So that really woke us up. And I said to him, what do we do now? And he was the second in charge at Oxford Medical School. And he said, well, I hope in 5 years it will be standard medical practice. And I said, well, what would that mean, you know, on the NHS? He said, everyone over 50 has a cognitive function test because you can see that slip in cognitive function 40 years before a diagnosis. If not good, you measure homocysteine, which we'll talk about.
Yep.
You know,
we've got your little kit here.
Yeah, exactly. Terribly important. And then if high, have the B vitamins. But here's the really sort of fascinating thing. Like, just recently, the front page newspapers have said £10 million trial funded by who? Bill Gates, Alzheimer's Research UK, and mainly the People's Lottery. So the people out there gave their money to fund this trial, which involves 5,000 people being tested for a blood test called p-tau. Now, we know p-tau is you get these neurofibrillary tangles. I mean, they're selecting people who think they've got a memory problem. They're testing p-tau, and they're going to tell you a few years later, guess what? People with memory problems have a high level of p-tau. Why are they doing this? It's the same as cholesterol and statins.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll say, now...
we've got a drug.
We've got a drug, right? Now, it's total waste of money. And if you think about it, it's £2,000 per person, 5,000 people. So what could I do with £2,000 for an individual? But why develop the blood test when you can do what is used to diagnose dementia online for free, which is a cognitive function test?
Absolutely.
So rather than your doctor saying, I'm going to take your blood. Oh, you got p-tau. Now you need a drug, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, it is a dark old web they weave, isn't it?
But it goes so deep. I'll give you an example. There's the World Dementia Council travel around the world, having these conferences, and it's invitation only. And the year before last, and they invite the government experts and, you know, all the influential people. The year before last, one of my professors, he couldn't go, and he said, please let Patrick go instead. And I went there with a friend of mine who's a major award-winning medical journalist. And they're banging on about amyloid, amyloid, amyloid. The idea is that your brain is full of amyloid plaque.
Yeah.
You know, it's a toxic protein. It's part of the inflammatory process, a bit like having plaque on your teeth, if you like. And the idea is if you get rid of the plaque, you know, you cure Alzheimer's. Now, the drugs do get rid of the plaque, and they shrink your brain, and 30% get brain bleeding or swelling, and the last two trials killed 7 people.
Okay, so just unfold that a little bit more. So
yeah.
The last trials killed 7 people.
2 trials, yeah.
Yeah, 2 trials. So yeah, that, to me, seems a lot in a trial.
It's about 1 in 400. Of course it is.
Yeah.
You know, if you go back 10 years, if a drug... I mean, let me put it another way. So, I mean, what happens is if you have a very, very weak effect of something... I mean, for example, if you have a trial of 100 people and one gets better, do you conclude that it's effective? You say, no, it could have been chance. I mean, let's say none in the placebo and one on the drug, you know, get better. You go, no, it could be chance. So if you have a very weak effect, what if you do a trial of 1,000 people? Now you've got 10 get better, or 10,000 people, now 100 get better. You say, yeah, that's not chance anymore.
Mm.
So when you have a really crap drug, what you've got to do is a very, very big trial. In the thousands, right?
Which in order that you might get a couple of people get better.
Exactly. So these are large trials, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's basically the thing. Lots of money. And, you know, there are all sorts of ways that they, what shall I say, cheat. Not cheat, sort of skew, you know, the results in the direction that you kind of want them to go. And in these, but the point really, even just before that, is the last 15 trials of these are injections of anti-amyloid antibodies. So little antibodies whiz into your brain, find the amyloid, kill it. That's the idea. It's sort of Pac-Man. It's basically like a vaccine. You know, it's a bit like, you know, mRNA. It's close to that. It's what we would call a biologic drug. It's not blocking an enzyme, which is what, you know, statins do. And in the last 15 trials, they work. They reduce amyloid plaque. But they have no clinical effect. So
nobody got better.
No one got better. And in these last, you know, there've been a series of trials and a lot of money going into this because they've spent nearly $100 billion. I mean, the official figure is $50 billion. I mean, it's a big money. And they're not going to give up. They're just not going to give up.
Well, they can't give up because they have to get their money back.
Exactly. So the point is, what happened was they just, in the last two trials, got over the point of statistical significance of placebo versus drug. No one got better. They just got a fraction less worse. Not clinically significant in the sense that if you were given the drug, you wouldn't notice. You know, your relative wouldn't notice, your doctor wouldn't notice, your carer wouldn't notice. And about, you know, 1 in 5 got brain bleeding or swelling, which is a very serious condition, from which originally in the last trial 3 died and the one before 2 died. But then a little while later, you know, another one pops off in one trial, another one pops off in the other trial. In other words, they're in hospital bleeding.
Yeah, this is something that I feel really passionate about. You know, I've recently had Barbara O'Neill on the show, and you know, she was hauled before the Australian courts and tribunals for saying that you could put a piece of apple in a muslin in a baby's mouth, and you know, the healing effects of that. And they said the baby could choke of that, and she said, well, you know, having muslin and apple in their mouths. And then they said that a baby, because she'd spoken about goat's milk, and they said, but a baby could die of goat's milk. And I know last time you were on the show, we talked about the fact that, you know, we're the only species that is drinking something designed for babies in our older age,
i.e.
milk.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, they come after all these little things that they can in the natural health world. And I know that you're a massive proponent of vitamin C therapy. But if one person died of that, you'd be in jail.
Well, not only that, but vitamin C would be banned.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's absolutely true. If you did a trial of vitamin C of 1,000 people and, you know, let's say high dose for COVID and one of them died, game over.
Yeah.
Simple as that. So we have a extraordinary, I mean, everyone really in neuroscience knows that the amyloid theory is dead. It's finished. It doesn't work. it's no longer ethical to put people on trials. But if you go on Facebook, people are queuing up to join these trials. They'll do anything because they're like, you know, their relative or they are losing their memory. I think there's going to be a cure. There's going to be a cure. There's going to be a cure. And there won't be a cure because the process that leads to cognitive decline, which my book is all about, and this, you know, let me say this is anything neurological, you know, Parkinson's, motor neuron disease, also
and kids, ADHD.
ADHD, autism, and we're almost not allowed to say it, but most neurodivergence is fundamentally neurologically related. And there are some very fundamental rules about how your brain is made and functions. And, you know, one of the critical things, and here's the sort of mind-blowing thing. The study I told you about was B vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
And they drive a process called methylation. Your actual brain cells have a skin, a membrane, through which all the talking happens. It's made out, I mean, your brain is 60% fat when you take the water out. It's made out of omega-3. And a very particular kind called DHA, very rich in fish. That omega-3, which is like a zigzaggy thing, and we can actually share a little film, binds to something called a phospholipid, very rich in eggs and fish. And the binding is done by this process, methylation B vitamins. So what got really interesting is that David Smith, Professor Oxford and his group, after they'd done their first trial, they then thought, well, hang on a second, we didn't really factor in omega-3. So they went back to their original blood samples and they split the group into thirds in relation to their blood plasma omega-3. And they found that the third with the lowest omega-3 had no benefit at all from the B vitamins. And the third with the highest had 73% less brain shrinkage, which brought them down to the level that you see in normal people with no cognitive decline at all. And then that triggered a little cascade where other studies had got modest effect on B vitamins, went back to their baseline blood samples, found that those with low omega-3 got no benefit, those with high, massive benefit. Studies on omega-3, because they've not all worked, and some fairly decent trials, and they found that the third with the highest homocysteine, which is the blood test, if it's high, it's bad. No effect of omega-3, but the third with the lowest, massive effect. So we get to the point where there is 73% less shrinkage, or, you know, two-thirds less shrinkage.
And that's a massive statistic.
Well, it's that versus 20% increased brain shrinkage.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got... Which is the drug. And the vitamins and omegas will cost you 10p a day. The drug is pitched at about £40,000 a year.
And how many people have Alzheimer's in the UK at the moment?
Oh, I should know the number off the top of my head.
You should, yeah. Shouldn't you?
No, I'll look at 790 dementia diagnoses per day. That's seven double-decker buses worth of people. Every 3 seconds, someone in the world is diagnosed. I was going to say a million. It says around 900,000 people in the UK currently have dementia, but this is about a year old. So it's around the million mark. Now, what people don't also realise is that it is the biggest killer. So the Office of National Statistics in 2022 said the number one killer, not cancer,
not heart disease.
It's Alzheimer's, dementia. It's dementia. So dementia is the biggest killer. It costs more than all of cancer and heart disease combined. Biggest healthcare cost by a long way. Biggest fear. It's overtaken the fear of gaining weight.
Oh, has it really?
Yeah. And it's preventable, you know, at least for 99% of people who do not have those causative genes. But let's just say, what if I have those causative genes? Even people with those causative genes who lower their homocysteine with B vitamins, increase their omega-3, exercise and do everything else, they do better. Because here's a really important thing. And my team, you know, I have a wonderful research, head of research, principal investigator, Associate Professor Tommy Wood at the University of Washington. And he and I and Professor Robert Lustig, who's the sugar expert, I've got his book here called Metabolical, you know, he's a genius. He's fantastic. and others. You know, David Smith is retired now, so he's represented by Dr. Andrew McCadden, and omega-3 experts. They're all in this paper, but basically there's the structure. Oh, and I want to say one thing before this as well. It doesn't matter what disease you're concerned with. If you get nutrition right for your brain, it will be right for your body.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be right for cancer.
Yeah, exactly.
It will be right for heart disease,
yep.
You know, diabetes, the whole lot.
So if you do this, you know, you are not only dementia-proofing yourself, you're cancer-proofing yourself, you're heart disease-proofing yourself, and so on. So effectively, you've got the structure of things. In this case, we can say brain cell. And when I said those omegas bind with the phospholipids, think eggs, fish, you know, et cetera, needing to be, that structure. Then you've got the function of the thing, and the function is the fuel supply. So in this case, it's glucose or ketones made from fat. A lot of people go into ketogenic type diets.
Yeah.
Then when you make energy, you know, the function of making energy in a brain cell, you make exhaust fumes. And they're oxidants, which is why smoking increases risk, pollution increases risk, antioxidants, eating blueberries, vitamin C, reduce risk. So you've got structure, you've got function, but you've got to use it. You've got to use the neural network. And that is why if you're blind or deaf, you have cataracts or hearing loss, you actually have a greater risk for dementia because you have less stimulation. But if you have cataract surgery or you get a hearing aid, you get less. If you exercise, and particularly if you exercise like something difficult, I mean, I'm 66, I've just got my paraglider license, you know, so I'm having, my whole body is having to adjust. Oh my God, what's going on here? And my brain is working, you know, something that challenges you, learning a new musical instrument or a new language or walking in hills as opposed to on a treadmill or dancing would be fantastic.
Well, I actually interviewed a wonderful woman about dancing, and it was something like 77% decrease in Alzheimer's and dementia for people that dance, whereas doing a crossword three times a week gave you zero, but the dancing... Yeah.
No.
It's massive.
And here's the weird thing, and this is why I said we've underestimated prevention. If you go through the book Upgrade Your Brain, and there are eight, you know, secrets, so to speak, but omega-3 is one, B vitamins is another, X and so on. And you go through it, it goes, oh, do you know, if my vitamin D is high compared to low, I've got 90 times less risk for Alzheimer's. If I dance, you know, it'll reduce my risk by 50%. If I have
76, you know, 76%. I mean, it's huge.
And actually, I haven't done this, but if you sort of went through and added up all the percentages, you realize you've just reduced your risk by 3,000%. So the point is that when we say, and I'll give you an example of this, the National Institute of Health, which is the US's sort of most authoritative group, one of their scientists looked at all of the studies on Alzheimer's prevention and attribute what's called the population attributable risk. How much of this is contributing to the risk for the population? And they attributed 22% to the homocysteine B vitamin thing, 22% to seafood omega-3 thing. And but what we've just learned is the studies on just omega-3 or just B vitamins are taking an average of people, some of whom are lacking omega-3 or lacking B vitamins. So that's why when we looked at B vitamins alone, on average for everyone, 53% less brain shrinkage. But in the group who had higher omega-3, 73%. So this combination, like we know that pollution increases your risk for dementia, but not in people with a low homocysteine and good B vitamins. So the point is every single risk factor is a bit like dancing. Even if you say dancing reduces your risk by X, actually dancing in people who have higher omega-3 and B vitamins may reduce it by 90%.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
And it's a, you know, it's kind of like, I remember years ago, I think it was Joan Larson who ran an addiction center in America, and she, you know, 12 steps and all the rest of it, which is absolutely fine. But she said, if you've scrambled your brains, sitting in a group and talking about it won't unscramble your brains. And right?
It's true.
And her point was that if you've been, you know, heavily hitting alcohol or drugs or whatever, your brain chemistry is completely messed up. You can't actually pay attention to the counseling. It's not going in. You know, the psychotherapy is fantastic, but it's not going in because your brain isn't working. So if you want to get a benefit from, you know, psychotherapy, for example, you need a functioning brain.
Yeah, you do.
So when you put the two things together, suddenly, and that is why we are always underestimated, all of these numbers, even the numbers in my book, are underestimated because they haven't factored in the combinations, right?
And this is really important. And I think with all the science that is done, they all work in such isolation that nothing is factored in. I mean, you know, when I ended up, you know, asking for consultants if all my conditions were connected, they don't know. They don't want to know. It's not part of their program. They're going, I just do this.
But they don't think in that way.
No, they don't.
And actually, what I just told you about the structure, function and utilization. I mean, years ago, when I was about 14, I was happened to be playing tennis with a very interesting physicist called Fritjof Capra. As you do at 14, who wrote the book The Tao of Physics and was one of the first sort of systems thinkers. And I remember him saying to me, Patrick, what is the difference between an inanimate object like this bicycle and yourself? And he said, both have parts.
Yeah.
The parts relate, you know, chain to the wheel, etc. But in an animate object, you've got this life that is flowing through it, you know, which vanishes when we die. You've still got the structure, function stopped. So that's the same sort of systems-based way of looking at things. You need to be stimulating the neural network. You need to have healthy structure, and you need to have a, you know, a really good fuel supply. And as soon as you start thinking in that way, which is not reductionist, you suddenly realize why there are 30 or 40 well-established risk factors for Alzheimer's, but we, for the first time, are really organizing them. And then where it gets really interesting is that cognitive function test that we got permission to digitize, and it's validated in studies, is the same test that you would do if you were referred to a memory clinic. Same test, which is designed like a diabetes test to find out if you have dementia or pre-dementia, which we call mild cognitive impairment. And if you don't, in other words, if your score is better than that, then you're okay. So it's a bit like I say there's three kinds of health, or, you know, there's vertically ill, you know, up, there's horizontally ill, which is when the doctor's called in, but then there's vertically well. So there's this, you know, if we call dementia red and pre-dementia orange, there's this vast green range. And I made a decision a while ago to split the green into yellow, light green, dark green. Now, literally, you know, last week, we've now tested 420,000 people. Every single day, 100 people, it's free, are going on foodforthebrain.org, clicking the button, doing the test. It's quite challenging.
Now, I tried to do the test and it is incredibly challenging. And I realised that I need to clean my glasses more often. because also, I'm dyslexic, which again is, you know, most probably because I haven't got the right level of everything in my body. Or my mum didn't. I don't know. My mum was really healthy. I don't know. But anyway, I found it incredibly hard.
Yeah, it's, and you know, you're matching things and seeing things. It's a sort of 10, I mean, it's followed by a questionnaire. So you want to give yourself 15 minutes, if not 20, uninterrupted, phone off. No one's going to call.
Didn't turn my phone off.
Yeah, you and do the job properly, you know.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, if you ask the question, well, is it good, you know, what's this green zone, right? So we just looked at hundreds of thousands of people who've done it. And we have found, and this is actually from about the age of 15 to 95, that there is almost a straight line that is with every year of age, the cognitive function score is getting less and less and less and less. There's like kind of dip in the middle, you know, but it's still going down.
I find this quite shocking that it's from 15.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I kind of thought it rocked off at my age or a bit before, you know. 15.
No, there is, I mean, around sort of 60, you start to get this sort of drop off. Of course, none of this has to happen. And we've got people who've engaged through what we're doing, because, by the way, the free test then tells you what to do. And sometimes, like if you don't score well on the B vitamin questions, they say, get a homocysteine test, which is this, right?
Yep.
And, you know, this doesn't lie. And I don't think my wife will mind me saying, but we both did the test And I score 7, which is perfect, annoyingly. And she scores 15, right? Which is, I mean, the average person my age will be over 12, and your brain is shrinking above 11. So she's in the brain shrinking zone. Some people do inherit genes that mean that they are less good at methylation and need to pay a little bit more attention to things like B vitamins.
But like you
So,
said, that's 1%, and your genes
well,
are.
no, these are not causative genes, but genes, basically genes make enzymes, and enzymes turn something into something else. You can inherit a what they call a polymorphism or a variant of a gene that means you're not quite so good at making the enzyme, so you need a little bit more B vitamins.
Sorry to interrupt this podcast. The Wellness Way has got a brand new interactive ebook out. I've created a beginner's guide to your natural health systems to help you navigate through the jungle of natural health. A banquet of knowledge wrapped up in a simple ebook, featuring some of my top guests from the podcast. As an added bonus, I've even thrown in my meditation album, The Wellness Awakening, From Past Lives to Passing. Head over to my webpage, phillyjlay.com, to grab your copy now. And while you're there, why don't you sign up for my newsletter? And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share this podcast so we can continue to get this information out. Remember, the doctor of your future is you. But you
So,
can do that. You
yeah.
turn your genes on and off by your
Exactly.
environment.
Exactly.
And
Yeah.
so once you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway, my lovely wife Gabby goes and gets, the pills. They're called Connect. I mean, I formulated this for a company. I mean, and religiously, it's the sort of thing. Takes them 3 months later, which is a perfect time. Retests, and she's 8. So she's
Gosh.
fine. She's sorted it. And her brain is working so much better. So the point is, you can do a test. I mean, you can do a questionnaire. It identifies your areas of risk. Then, if you wish to, you can really confirm that biologically. This test is omega-3, vitamin D, HbA1c, which is the blood sugar thing, and homocysteine. And you do it, and maybe you're fine on all of them, but maybe you're not. And if you go, well, how much vitamin D do you need? Or how much omega-3 do you need? Find out. What happens is that when I said those brain cells have omega-3 bound to something, they're bound in there. What we actually measure in the omega-3 index are the bound in omega-3 in the red blood cell membrane. So it's a 3 month test because your red blood cells live for 3 months. So in other words, if you eat salmon that day, it won't change it. It will tell you the last 3 months of your omega-3 status. In Japan, and we're actually measuring the percentage of fatty acids in the red blood cell membrane that is DHA and EPA, which are the two really powerful omega-3s that you find in fish. And in Japan, the average is 10%. Above 8% is optimal. In the UK, the average is 4%. And if you're vegan, you go, oh, I wonder if I'm really doing it. Have a test, find out. The average vegan will be about 3%, unless they supplement.
Unless they supplement. I remember that one of the first lectures, I think it was the first lecture I ever heard you speak in person at the College of Naturopathic Medicine a few years back, and you were talking about the first baby that had actually died because it was B deficient. And a baby, a baby is getting its
Well, there have
food
been,
from its
yeah, no, I mean,
mother.
there
I
have
mean, this
been,
was a few years ago that I.
I'm trying to look along. So, I mean, look, I'm not pro or
Sorry.
anti anything.
Sorry, I have to say, it's such an honor to sit in front of this huge, huge bookcase here. So,
They're not all mine.
I know, but that it's just an extraordinary collection, and 47 of them are yours.
Well, I
Surely
mean,
this one.
well, I mean, the thing was, there have been 12 deaths of vegan
12
infants,
now.
12 deaths of vegan
Okay.
infants,
As I said,
and
it was a long time ago that I came to see you,
so
Phil.
I go, oh my God, I mean, if someone chooses to be vegan, which is a life choice, which you can do, you will need to supplement omega-3, which you can get from algae, or it can be extracted, processed from algae. You will need to supplement B12. The last death was actually in a couple who ran a health food shop. They were both vegan, probably a very good diet in many respects, but the mother was B12 deficient, didn't know it. And if the mother's B12 deficient, the baby's B12 deficient. You know, it's not in the breast milk. And effectively that causes the baby to die. So I wrote this book to know that if you choose to be vegan, you have got to know a few things, you know. And the thing is, what's happening now is that so many ultra-processed foods full of junk, you know, they go, oh, my God, our shit product's vegan, right? Now we can use that to sell it.
I know.
So you can be on a really bad vegan diet. You could be on a really good vegan diet, but you have to supplement B12 and you have to supplement omega-3, and you also have to supplement choline, which is the phospholipid, phosphatidylcholine, which is what's in eggs. And if you're vegan, you've got to do it with lecithin granules.
Okay, I don't know those.
Yeah, well, you see, the brain, there are three fundamentals for the brain. One is omega-3.
Yeah.
Let's say it's the plank, right? The other is the phospholipids, and we'll call that the nail. And the third is to, I mean, it's a bit like if I say to a builder, you know, if you give a builder planks, you get a house. No. If you give them nails, do you get a house? No. No. If you give them planks, nails, and a hammer,
you might get a house.
You'll get a house. The hammer is the methylation, the B vitamins.
Right.
So you have to have all three. The phospholipids, we do, they're semi-essential. In other words, the body can make some. So they're not quite as critical as omega-3 and B vitamins. And if you're not eating fish and you're not eating eggs, a tiny bit in broccoli, a tiny bit in almonds, lecithin granules or lecithin capsules, which you can buy in the health food store, comes from soya originally, is the highest source of phosphatidylcholine. So I supplement every day omega-3 plus lecithin plus B vitamins, and I eat every week 3 servings at least
of fish,
of oily fish. And do you know what is the single richest source of that omega-3 DHA?
Mackerel.
Caviar.
Oh, caviar.
It's the highest.
Is it? I've never tried it. I've just never fancied eating fish eggs in my life.
Yeah, but even, you know, like taramasala, I mean, fish eggs are good. But
no, taramasala I can't do either.
Yeah, but why is caviar, caviar? The sturgeon egg is by far the richest source of DHA. Now, what... Just to sort of contextualise this, and I love telling the story of, because I'm living down in Wales on 20-acre farm, and they found this ancient, oldest by a long way, complete Homo sapiens remains, skeleton.
And there's a little camp there, isn't there? There's a village that's been built around
it. No, I don't think there is. I don't think so. I think it's really hard to get to the cave, and I've been meaning to get there, and I think it's not really like, you know, it's not like a tourist thing. Paviland... woman, they called this find, because they had all this jewellery made out of shells. Now, actually, when they get down to the DNA analysis, it's a man, not a woman. And when they analyse the bones, they are eating 1/4 of their diet as seafood, marine food. And if you think today that they must have been expending 2 or 3 times the calories through exercise, you know, hunting, gathering, collecting wood, etc., than we are. So my diet today would have to be half of all the calories of my diet today would have to be marine food, which is the easiest food, mussels, crabs, you know, little rock pools when the tide comes in and out.
Well, if you think about it, if they're living by water, there was. I went to an Iron Age. Yeah. It was obviously a different thing, but I went to an Iron Age village in Wales many moons ago with my niece when she was little. Yeah. And you know, there were quite a few kind of the spears for the fish and everything. But the fish have got to be easier to capture than the deer.
I mean, the point is, you imagine tiny population, vast rivers, estuaries. I mean, they're loaded with oysters, mussels, things you just pick up. And of course, it's not the father's nutrition that counts, it's the mother, you know, because it's the mother day by day that counts. You know, the dad might be off hunting, occasionally lucky, you know, but the mother's cruising along the rivers, the estuaries, picking up fish. And it's so absolutely obvious. And David Attenborough, of course, was the one who really sort of put this idea on the map. That's why we became upright. We were the ape. We didn't suddenly drop out of the trees and suddenly go hunting with spears, which is the most ridiculous idea, because I happen to take people on safari. You know, the last thing you ever do is stand up. You know, it's the crouchers who can sprint who get the prey. And we are really slow, you know?
Yeah.
So it just doesn't make sense at all. And then I'm very proud to say that I've just acquired my fifth grandchild.
Oh, congratulations.
A lovely little boy called Bo.
Oh.
Bo Dexter. And anyway, there's the picture at birth, and he's got vernix on it. That's the white, waxy stuff that babies are born with, that they wipe off, that is waterproof. And David Attenborough said, I've never seen vernix in a land-based mammal. Mm. I wonder if it occurs in a sea mammal, like a seal. And some marine biologists picked up on this. And sure enough, the dolphin was the last creature to leave the land and commit fully to being in the sea. They have every single bone we have in our hands and arms in their flippers. And the marine mammals have this waxy, waterproof vernix layer, as do we. And you know, if you put a baby into water, they already know.
They know exactly what to do.
It takes them a couple of years to learn to walk.
Yeah.
But they already know how to swim.
No, I know. We had the conversation on the last show because I threw my babies in, you know, at kind of 2 weeks. And it was terrifying. But you just go and go. Yeah. You know, I knew that if you did that then, they'd learn how to do it.
So the genius Professor Michael Crawford, you know, who really proved all this, has written a book called The Shrinking Brain. And just to put this into context, 6.5 million years ago, we split from the chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos. They maintain, like a chimp has a brain size of 380 grams. And at the peak of Homo sapiens, about 30,000 years ago, brain size is 1,700 grams. That's why.
Which is about 1.5 pounds?
1.5 kilos.
Kilos.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, big brain compared to a chimp, which has stayed the same.
Yeah.
And so that's happened because of the environment that they were in. It's not the genes, because the genes are only like 1.2% difference. It's the environment or the conditions of existence. And now, today, the average Homo sapiens has a brain size of 1,330. So we've dropped from 1,700 or 1,600, 1,700 down to 1,300 or so. So in other words, we've lost something like 20% of our brain size over the last 20, 30,000 years, probably coinciding with moving into land-based agriculture. Less of along the coasts, less eating marine foods and so on. And actually, I was just interviewing Professor Michael Crawford, who's 93, and has worked something out that no one has ever been able to explain in any sufficient manner, which is how do the photons, the energy that hit our eye, turn so precisely into the image that I see of you and me in colour. And he's worked it out with quantum physics. So it reminds me a bit of like Oppenheimer in the movie. You know, he's 93, he's worked it out, he's published the paper. I'm sure he's correct. It will have to be proven, but I'm sure he's correct. You really do not need to lose your mind. And this is what's happening. Our brain is shrinking. Our IQ is falling. Just in March, a major global study confirms that neurological diseases are accounting for disability years and reduced years of life, loss of years, in 43% of the world's population, 3.4 billion people.
That's a huge number.
It is. And the Federation of European Neuroscientists, they say we have a brain health emergency. We've now had four government reports, one independent report. year after year after year, the cost goes up and up and up, and still it annoys me. I read some article in The Guardian or here or there or whatever, and some twat says, oh, they're just diagnosing more.
Oh, yeah, because they say that with...
Well, it's just the psychiatrists are just, you know, and of course we do know. I mean, like right now what's happening is a lot of kids being diagnosed with autistic spectrum disorder. And it is true that what's happening is that, you know, that the mum or dad are going, you know, I've got quite a few of those symptoms.
Yeah.
So we are getting an increase in diagnosis now of adult autism. So it is true that there is an increase from diagnosis, but it is a very, very small part of a massive overall trend where this year we go into 100 in the UK with, I don't know, an adult population maybe of 50 million or something. 100 million prescriptions of antidepressants are expected this year. 1 in 5 on antidepressants. 1 million prescribed to teenagers. ADHD going through the roof.
Off the scale.
Yeah.
And you talk about, you know, the fact that we can diagnose it better, but I, you know, I say time and time again, if that is the case, you know, I look at my daughter who's diagnosed ADHD, and I see a lot of the traits in me. So, but you know, I think I'm absolutely normal. So I think we also overdiagnose it in order to get children on prescription medicines.
Well, there's a lot of that.
I, you know, any doctor that doesn't ask you about your lifestyle and prescribes you a medicine is a drug pusher. They're not a doctor.
Yeah.
But also, I have a school actually just round the corner from here that I know very well, that they take all these young boys out. And I have to say they're predominantly black boys.
Yeah.
And they're all highly autistic and they have a carer with each child. And you have to look... Where are the adults like that? Where are the, you know, this is highly autistic. There aren't 40-year-olds like it. There aren't 50-year-olds like it. There aren't 90-year-olds like it. So we've got to look at what's being done to these young people. Yeah. And, you know, so we have to talk about not just food, but we have to talk about vaccine schedules. We have to talk about a lot of problems.
Well,
here.
I mean, there's, you know, SEN schools, special education, are just bursting at the seams.
Yeah.
And it's creating a big problem because now, you know, there are a lot of schools where 30%, sometimes even 50% of the kids in the class have special educational needs. And that, of course, is having an effect on everyone. And the thing that really sort of irritates me about this, I mean, there's a chapter in my book called Building Healthy Brains. And I think I wanted to call it Building Healthy Brains and Preventing Neurodivergence because, in effect, and it's all very well sort of defined, but we sort of softened the word to neurodivergent and it can include more anxious, can't concentrate, you know, some aggression, some socialization problems, withdrawal. You know, there's all sorts of things. And I'm not talking here about a super functioning person who's different to someone else, you know, just very focused. But the vast majority of people who fit into this autistic spectrum disorder, neurodivergent, the vast majority have got some symptoms or functional issues that cause them pain. You know, that they can't socialize, that they're really awkward in certain circumstances or whatever. They may have strengths, they may have weaknesses.
Oh, no, these poor kids that I'm talking about, they can barely walk.
Yeah.
They need a carer to help them.
They can't walk and they can't talk.
And they can't talk.
Yeah. And I mean, it reminds me years ago when I was invited to sort of do a little transformation job on a school for, I think it was Trevor McDonald Tonight. And we had an incredible effect on the school. But one of the girls had cerebral palsy, which is a lack of oxygen to the brain at birth. You know, could have been strangled by the, you know, the cord or whatever it was. And she couldn't walk without, you know, a frame. And so, you know, the parents' attitude was give her what she likes, ice cream, whatever. You know, it's like the damage is done. Let's just make her happy sort of thing. Anyway, yeah, we found out that she was dairy allergic and gave her certain vitamins, omega-3s and all the rest of it. And I think it was about 3 months later, she was walking without a frame. And this is a girl that's had irreversible damage at birth.
But for how many years before she saw you?
She's probably about 7. So, you know, it's like that.
It's a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we had a guy and this is the year before last, and his wife kept finding him in the wrong room at night because he couldn't find the loo in his own house. You know, went to the doctor, referred to the memory clinic, diagnosed with mixed dementia, which means Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. So what can we do? And I said, nothing. A couple of months later, they tried to enroll him on the drug trial. And, you know, he did the foodforthebrain.org test, and they really followed everything. And by the way, he didn't realize omega-3 and vitamin B, so that he did. Cut down on carbs, cut out sugar. Every day had this, there's a type of oil called C8 oil, medium chain triglyceride oil. It's sort of, you get it from coconut, but there's not much in coconut oil. You have to extract it. It's very nice tasting. 2 tablespoons of that every day. That makes ketones, because when you're, the sugar supply to your brain is messed up because you're insulin resistant, because you've had too much sugar. Ironically, you end up sugar starved, so your brain can't work. And that's where these ketones and the CAO really help. Had that. He learned very quickly. If they went to dinner with some friends and ate carbs, he was worse the next day. Went to bed a bit earlier to get more sleep, which is good. He's now joined a Morris dancing group. You know, this is exercise.
Living, he's dancing, you see.
Yeah, he's dancing.
He's dancing.
Exercise coordination, et cetera, et cetera. He's planted his whole garden. He's back on the computer. He has a concept of time, which he had completely lost.
So this just goes to show that you say it's not reversible, it's preventable.
Yes.
But this is somebody that has got a hell of a lot better. You've just talked about a man that, you know, his life was falling apart and, you know, he couldn't do things and now he can do things. So I think, can you say it's reversible?
No, I don't. And actually, I've been attacked recently for not saying it's reversible. Right. And there's a guy called Dale Bredesen. He's written a very good book, End of Alzheimer's, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, he and others I know have quite aggressively, a bit like this fellow, done everything and people have improved. But the reason why I would say Alzheimer's is not actually in his study, he didn't have anyone with diagnosed Alzheimer's. And you diagnose Alzheimer's by scanning the brain and seeing the holes.
Yeah.
So if I was to say Alzheimer's is reversible, I would have to have someone who's diagnosed with Alzheimer's with a before and after brain scan where I could show that the holes had gone. So let's take this guy. He's too late in this cycle, probably, to not continue to get bad. But what's happened is we've really, really slowed that down, and he's improved, you know, for a while.
Tremendously.
Why? Because some of those half dead brain cells, not yet dead, they haven't gone. That's what Alzheimer's is, dead brain cells, which are not going to come back particularly quickly. Those half dead brain cells come back to life because they're getting some good fuel. You're mopping up all the exhaust fumes, you're reducing inflammation, you're getting a better blood supply, which of course exercise and dancing and all that will do. So you know, it's a bit like a really old car that you actually service and it appears to come back to life and it will live longer and its decay will be slower. So you can absolutely, and especially the earlier you start, see some, you know, significant improvements. But I don't want to over exaggerate and say that is the reversal of Alzheimer's.
Okay, so yeah. I just want to come back to the fact that today is Alzheimer's Prevention Day.
Yes.
Now, I'm going to come back to your book, Upgrade Your Brain. Yeah. This is your press day today, and I'm really lucky to be here for your press day and to have this interview. Thank you, Patrick. And I know that you have spoken or contacted a lot of the Alzheimer's prevention societies and charities.
Yes.
How did that go?
Well, just before answering that, let me explain what Alzheimer's Prevention Day is. What happened was I contacted the leading people in the world, from China to Japan to America, the UK, and so on, who were the absolute experts in something to do with prevention. Neurologists, neuroscientists, psychiatrists, you know, and so on. Nutritionists, physiologists, exercise experts, and so on. And I said, you know, could we sort of get together and form a group? And we did. Every single one said yes. And it's actually Dementia Awareness Week right now. We thought, do you know, the one thing one needs to be aware of is that this is a preventable disease.
Mm.
So we said, why don't we make Alzheimer's Prevention Day? Right. And on this day, we launch a website, alzheimerspreventionprevention.info. There's a 3-minute rapid test you can do, so you can instantly see what's going on. There, each of the experts made a 3-minute film about something, not drinking too much alcohol, sleep, B vitamins, omegas, exercise, whatever it is. So there's, you can see all the professors from Harvard, from Washington University, from Oxford, from all the rest.
So this all sounds very promising.
Very promising. And they're all saying something that you can actually do. And then there's an ice bucket challenge, so to speak, where you, the member of the public, can make a film on your phone, 30 seconds or less, saying, I floss my teeth to help prevent Alzheimer's, or I walk the dog and get some exercise to help prevent Alzheimer's, or I eat a mackerel, or I eat an egg, or I supplement B12. No commercial products, you know, are allowed in this, but something. And the reason is we're trying to shift this paradigm from, oh, it's just what happens to everybody when they get,
when old, get
old, and we'll wait for someone to make a drug, and, you know, and so on, to, no, this is rubbish. There are absolutely things we can do. So, as a consequence, with the world's experts, and we actually ran a conference a couple of weeks ago with all the world experts, all recorded, pure science, absolutely fantastic, no question. The book is full of, I think, 400 references. They're not in the book to waste space. That, you know, you see the little number and you can see it. I mean, there's no question. No one has ever questioned the science. So I go to Alzheimer's Society. I go to Alzheimer's Research UK, whose banner is We Exist for a Cure, right? I go to Dementia UK and Alzheimer's Society, they say, we don't do prevention, actually. We don't do it.
We don't do prevention.
Yeah, yeah. And I go to Dementia UK, they say, well, we don't do prevention. We sort of, we're involved with people who have somebody with dementia, a carer or a relative, you know, that's our, you know, which is all laudable work. And they did say, you know, maybe you could help us do prevention. And Alzheimer's Research UK, they claim that 5% of their research money goes towards prevention. But it looks like this could be a drug. So in other words, if high blood pressure is a risk factor and you do a trial on a drug to lower your blood pressure, that would be classified as prevention research. So probably 5% of the 5% is actually on diet and nutrition, right?
Yeah.
And then to make it even worse, Alzheimer's Research UK funded or part funded the original B vitamin trial I was telling you about. So they fully know about it.
They know about it.
It's all published and they deny it.
They deny it.
Yeah, they say you don't need B vitamins unless you're sort of chronically deficient. They deny it.
And well, you got in trouble a few years ago talking about D vitamins, vitamin D.
Oh, yeah, I got busted for a campaign saying that everyone in the winter must take vitamin D.
Yeah.
I got done by the Advertising Standards Agency.
Yeah, that it was a lie. And then a few months later, in the
government announced it.
Announced. And now everybody knows that,
you know,
you're meant to supplement your D vitamin.
Yeah, but an interesting thing there is, again, because if you say, let's say the government decide to do prevention, which, you know, vitamin D. So what do they do? A few ads, a few announcements, and we now have about 5% of people in Britain in the winter take vitamin D, 5%. So one of the issues is, if you're going to do prevention, how do you do it? And the answer is you do it personally, and on big numbers, it's got to be digitally. So that's what we're doing. You know, you come in, you do a test, it's accurate, it shows you where your risk is, it helps you make changes. We're about to develop coaches. We've got Zoom groups happening. And so this thing could be scaled up to millions.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we don't, you know, we can't say yet, you know, come back in 5 years when we've got over 1 million people who are doing all this. And, you know, there's no question.
I don't think it'll take you 5 years. I mean,
you've built this hugely
quickly. but it's something that frightens people. I mean, you know, when I lost my memory, which they call brain fog, you know, and I found myself driving down the motorway and then had no idea where I was or why I was there what I was doing. And you go to bed at night and you can't remember what you've done for the day.
And
it's terrifying.
Yeah, and you can get rid of that. I mean, read the book. Go to alzheimerspreventionprevention.info, watch the films, go to foodwiththebrain.org. which is the fullest questionnaire.
Yeah, which is your webpage.
Yeah.
You'll do charity.
The charity again. They do it. The amazing thing is we funded the charity, and I know you became a friend. It's 50 quid a year.
That's it. 50 quid a year. Yeah. So just do it because you all know somebody that needs this.
And if you don't, I mean, the thing is, I've got scientists who really should have Nobel Prizes. Like the man at Oxford, who's published hundreds of papers, the best possible randomized placebo-controlled trials, exactly the same as the drug trials, except that they work and have no side effects and are completely cheap.
But there's no money to be made in them.
No, I mean, one of the big pharma guys came to David Smith and said, if this was patentable, as in man-made, you can't patent a vitamin, it's a multi-billion dollar drug, end of story. So they already know that this we exist for a cure, you know, that exists.
Yeah,
they know it.
But they
funded it, and they know it, and they want you to give money to make a drug that is not going to happen, and they deny prevention. So when we got all these world experts together, I mean, we're talking about the top professors in the world from the top universities in the world. I invited each charity. I said, "Would you like a free VIP place to come? We're recording it all, get the recordings, you know, just get up to speed." And none of them wanted to even have somebody come. And then and then I went to the Dementia World Dementia Council meeting, right? They had a section on prevention. One of my professors said, "Please let Patrick go instead of me, I can't go." Foodforthebrain.org is the leading prevention charity. They wouldn't let me in.
They wouldn't let you in?
They wouldn't let me in. And, they say it's invitation only and there's only a limited number of seats. And I'm standing there at the desk and there are 20 badges of people I know, Professor this and that, who didn't come. So in other words, they got 20 empty seats.
And they wouldn't let
you in. And I think I didn't get let in because the last time when they're banging on about amyloid, I stood up and said, you know, the B vitamins with omega-3 have reduced brain shrinkage by 73%. You know, would anyone care to comment? And I know these people, you know, and they turned to the panel and not one of them said anything. There is no denial of anything I'm saying. We have not had a single challenge on any of the science. It's all true.
I just find this, I've got this smile on my face, but it's not funny.
No.
I mean, I'm laughing because I just can't believe they wouldn't let you in.
Yeah.
You know, you have the biggest charity doing the most work in the UK, probably one of the biggest in the world doing this kind of work, and they won't let you in. Yeah. And it's
what I call a lemdemic.
I love that, a lemdemic.
See, what we got here is, you know, falling down the cliff are an endless supply of lemmings, of people falling into brain disease, broken bits. And we've got lemming research and lemming society and the lemming this. And fair enough, these are people who are trying to make the last few years of lemmings a little bit cozier, you know. And it's called the lemdemic, waiting for a cure.
I love that. Right? You got a picture of that?
I have.
Can you send it to me, love?
Yeah, yeah. And the second part of this, which is called figure two, a couple of radical lemmings up the top of the cliff have put up a sign that says, "Don't jump." So when I was at a meeting of all these, you know, eminent, you know, charities and all the rest of it for a new commission on dementia, and they were saying, we need a big result. I said, well, how about having less people get it?
Right? Wouldn't that be radical?
Right. And then now the most conservative figure, which is wrong because it's studies that have not included homocysteine and various other things, conclude that 40% of dementia is preventable. That's the most, no one denies that. It's way too low, but let's just say, for sake of maths, half. So I turned round to them and said, if half of dementia is preventable, shouldn't half of all the research money go into prevention?
Preventing it.
Yeah, because the things that prevent it are not patentable, they're not profitable, they're exercise, they're dance, they're, you know, having a hearing aid or omegas or B vitamins or sugar or whatever. And, you know, at some point we have to say, I'm not giving you money until you can show me that half of the money that you are taking from me is going into prevention research.
This is something very dear to my heart, and very sadly, a friend of mine's step-granddaughter has got cancer, and her daughter is doing a run for Great Ormond Street Hospital, which is, you know, fantastic that she wants to go and do that run for a hospital, but I got sent the flyer, and it's to go on cancer research. Mm-hmm. I can't bring myself, there is nothing in me that can bring myself to give money to cancer research. I stopped a long time ago. Because it is only, if they had spent 1%, one tiny weeny percent on prevention, same as Alzheimer's, it would be a whole different story, but they're not going to do that. This is all money that goes into the pockets of Big Pharma to keep funding for them to get their next golden bullet.
But do you know where it came from? Because I think it's really quite interesting. And Michael Crawford and his co-author David Marsh makes this so clear. So years ago, very bright guy, Darwin. You know, he observes evolution and he says there are two driving forces of evolution. One is the conditions of existence and the other is natural selection. And of the two, and he said this in every volume of his book, the conditions of existence are the most important. And this is obvious. So what I mean by this is that suddenly, I don't know, a meteor strikes, you know, and the conditions change, or global warming happens. So the conditions change.
Or global warming doesn't happen.
Or doesn't happen. Yeah, but whatever it is, but the conditions change, like it's very, very well, whatever. Certain species and variations of species do better or worse. That's natural selection. So change the conditions, a bit like, you know, suddenly we're urbanized and there are certain animals that adapt very well, foxes, you know, but I don't know, wolves don't, whatever it is. But the conditions change first and then you have natural selection. So always conditions of existence are important. And that's why we can say for sure that we could not have become Homo sapiens without a different set of conditions. In other words, we are the ape that exploited wetlands, swamplands and water's edge. It wasn't genes. And the crazy thing, and this really is super crazy, was back in the Darwin day, a man called Weissman did an experiment where he chopped the tails off rats. And their babies were born with tails. And for some strange logic, he concluded that this is proof that natural selection is more powerful than conditioning. Because you're going, I don't quite understand how that works.
No.
And it was very strange because there was a lecture and some professor was saying this. And there was someone in the audience who said, well, with a name like Weissman, he must have known this because Jewish people have been chopping the foreskins off boys for years. And still, the next generation, you know, farmers, it proves nothing. It was absolutely true. But what happened was it created the neo-Darwinists who buried the conditions of existence because natural selection means whites are superior to blacks. You know, the aristocratic bloodline is more secure. You know, is more superior to the plebs and all the rest of it. So basically it led into what then became genetics and genetic superiority. And still, and I can't believe this is still happening. I met a very bright man who's funded lots of things. You know, he's actually quite very into all this B vitamins, homocysteine and stuff. And his major funding is for cancer genes.
Oh my God.
You know, and
where we can all that's so old news.
It is so old news. You know, now here's a shocker and it really points the way. 1900s, for an Englishman to get into the army to fight in the Boer War, they had to drop the minimum height to 5 foot. In other words,
oh, my height.
Yeah, humans had shrunk, right? That's what happened. Why had they shrunk? Because of the industrialized diet, they didn't know about protein. So it's only after the 1900s we learnt you need protein for size. go to work on an egg, good British breakfast, bacon, sausages, and so on. So let's say, it's not quite the right figures, but 50 years later, we got 6-footers rather than 5-footers. So a very short period of time, a change in the conditions of existence, eating protein, causes this massive change in this case, size. Mm. What we're experiencing right now is exactly the same thing, but in reverse with the brain. It is the change in the conditions of existence, lack of omega-3, B vitamins, too much sugar, etc. That is, it's fast.
And our sleep patterns going to pot.
It's fast. I mean, if we're having this conversation in 30 years, the world is a mess.
Because we'll be here in 30 years if we're having this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, there are predictions that maybe a third, maybe a half of children will have, you know, significant, you know, neurodevelopmental issues, you know, and they're the next generation. So when you say all these kids with autism, 1 in 6 special educational needs, that's 1 in 6 adults.
Yeah.
You know, are unable to function, you know.
So nobody wanted to come and talk to you about this for your book launch. Nobody wanted to let you into a conference. This is a very, they have no interest whatsoever in preventing Alzheimer's. So what can people do?
Well,
they can read your book.
They can
go to your webpage.
Yeah.
And I want you, you've got 8 steps here.
Mm-hmm.
And just very quickly, Patrick, just take us through the 8 steps that you can do.
Number one, the omega-3s. Really important.
Okay, so really important. Yeah. Can you give us how much omega-3 should people be taking a day?
If you supplement, you look for a supplement which will give you DHA, 500 milligrams. And you'll probably have to take 2 fish oil capsules to get that. And, this is for the optimum, have oily fish 3 times a week. We say smash it. S for salmon, M for mackerel, A for anchovies, S for sardines, and H for herring kipper. So they're the really, really good ones, right?
Okay.
So that's omega-3. Second is the B vitamins. It's often to do with B12. A lot of older people don't absorb it very well. In truth, if you're over 50, you should have a homocysteine test. You know this thing?
Yeah.
It's just worth doing. It actually is a biomarker for 100 diseases. Any neurological, any psychological.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's published. And causative for Alzheimer's. So we say amyloid is not. If you give B vitamins, you lower the homocysteine, you stop the brain shrinkage, you increase the brain volume. It's causative, right? So B vitamins. But in any event...
And where would you get the best B vitamins from? Because you can't buy iodine in the shoppers anymore.
The B12 is in animal products. So eggs and fish are very, very good sources. Folate is in foliage. So greens and beans and nuts and seeds and so on.
But that isn't to be confused with folic acid, which is the synthetic stuff put in bread.
We can talk about that. It's not that bad. It's not that bad. But it is crazy to put it in bread. But we can go off on that one in a minute. But you need folate.
Okay.
So yeah, you need folate, you need B6. That's the B vitamins. Next secret is that the two actually work together. You know, we spoke about that. Next is sugar. You mentioned it at the beginning. Type 3 diabetes,
yep.
Alzheimer's. So the sugar thing is absolutely...
crucial to get that out.
Crucial, yeah.
And it's really hard to get that out in
We haven't mentioned antioxidants, of which vitamin C is one. So all the herbs and spices, fruits, not smoking, you know, all the... And actually, we have developed, and are launching it last month, a world first, which is a test that measures absolutely your antioxidant status.
Oh, wow. I want that because I work so hard on my antioxidants.
Well,
I make sure I have my 30 a week.
If you're anyone into nutrition, you'll know that the single most powerful antioxidant in the body is called glutathione.
Yep, the master antioxidant.
Exactly. So basically, imagine it like this. Around your body, at any point in time, in every cell, you've got metabolic fires. In other words, you're burning fuel. You're getting fires. Of course, if you're sick, you've got a lot of fires, a lot of inflammation, a lot of oxidation. And glutathione and vitamin C, they're the two, is like the water in the fire truck that's whizzing around trying to put out these fires. The water becomes steam, which is called oxidized glutathione. And that's it. We measure, and this is really a world first, the ratio of the fully loaded glutathione, the water, versus the spent, steamy, oxidized glutathione.
Yep.
So if you're putting out loads and you've got lots of fires, you're going to have a lot of steam. And if you're running out of water, you're going to have very low glutathione. If you've got a lot of glutathione and very little steam, you're metabolically superbly healthy. And it's a world first. And we actually learned that this glutathione is so potent that quite a few of the studies measuring it haven't actually measured it right, because the second the blood leaves your body, it oxidizes.
Yep.
So we've had to develop a very special dry blood spot target. So you prick your finger, drop the blood on, instantly fixed, send it to the lab. It's a world first. Because the four horsemen of the mental health apocalypse are brain fats, omega-3, vitamin D, phospholipids. We've spoken about them. Two, methylation, B vitamins. Three, sugar. And we measure that with HbA1c. Four, antioxidants, which is what this is about. Five, healthy gut. And we can go into that area. It's a little bit more prospective there. I'd actually rather say healthy gut and gums, because the evidence for dental health...
It's all connected.
It's very connected.
That is the beginning. That is the pathway into the gut.
And, you know, we get infection and bacteria in the mouth, and actually it can also get into the brain. So there is a mouth microbiome, and we find pathogens in the mouth and the brain. So dental health is very important, and it is the first part of the gut. Healthy gut. Next, active body exercise. Next, active mind. Next, sleep and calm. An active mind, by the way, is not only intellectual, also social. Socializing is so important. We are so social.
And laughing and having fun. And,
I mean, I think
that's all part of it,
actually. I mean, social to humans is like fish to water. We don't even notice it. We are social beings. And then the last one we call sleep and calm. And it's really recovery. What does a dog do after a walk? Goes to sleep. You know, so it's,
what do I do after a walk? Go to sleep.
it's brilliant. And I was actually just saying to my friend, Professor Tommy Wood at University of Washington, or associate professor or assistant professor, and becoming associate professor, he trains Formula One racing drivers. So he's like an expert in optimizing brain function. And he's the head of our research. And he's our principal investigator. And stress is bad. So too much stress is a risk factor for cognitive decline. But really using your mind is good. And I said last weekend, the wind really picked up. I was up a mountain and having trouble getting off it on my paraglider. I got blowback. You suddenly launch this thing. It's quite sort of dangerous, really. And a very nice Yorkshireman popped out of the sky. He was more qualified than me and helped me. And I learned certain techniques. And it was good. And then I got off and I was flying up there with eagles. Well, not actually eagles. They were red kites.
Red kites.
We were flying together and the thermals. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
So I said, here I'm in a situation where on the one hand, absolute stimulation, using my mind, using my body, everything's engaged. So that would reduce my risk. But on the other hand, I'm stressed, which would increase my risk. You know, must be the same.
But then when the stress is over.
Yeah. So he said the critical thing is the recovery.
Yeah.
So I got home and I have a bath outdoors in Wales, a hot bath. You know, it's beautiful. Put in some Epsom salts, nice hot bath. And then I make a hot chocolate, no sugar, cacao. It's very good for the brain.
Absolutely.
I put in cinnamon, nutmeg, and a little bit of smoked paprika.
I haven't had it with paprika.
Yeah,
I drink a lot of cacao.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, but every single one of those, this is antioxidant power, improving the circulation of the mind. So, you know, it's the recovery. So you kind of, you know, one by one, we learn these little things. I mean, they're not big. It could be, you know, walking, going for a 50-minute walk. It could be, we've built an app now called the Upgrade Your Brain Cook app. And if you go to foodforthebrain.org/...
And we're going to put that in the show notes, foodforthebrain.org. That
in this
is
case,
absolutely
in UIB is Upgrade Your Brain, UIB Cook app. You get this app on your phone, and basically you can pick breakfast, lunch, dinner, etc. And across those four horsemen, the brain fats, the B vitamins, the sugar and the antioxidants, and you might have a meal that's really good in everything except antioxidants. So it will then show you what your next meal needs to be.
So that you get the antioxidants, exactly. So you're just keeping the cycle going the whole time.
So it's like a game, and now you're learning. So one by one, I mean, I did something, you know, I had some tamarind salata. I know you don't like it.
No.
And it's very good for you, though. And I wanted some scrambled eggs. And I thought, well, what happens if I put some tamarind salata in the scrambled eggs? Now, actually, it was completely delicious. And I had it on some pumpernickel sort of sonnenbrot, you know, sort of bread. So I've got the whole grain, you know, I've ticked the omegas, I've ticked the phospholipids in the eggs, you know, etc. So the point is that there's just little bits. And, you know, there's the thing called the 3-6-36 rule, 3 weeks to break a habit, 6 weeks to make a habit, 36 weeks to hardwire a habit, right?
It's not that long, really.
Yeah.
You know, I'm all about, my whole journey to heal was, I found at first so hard.
Yeah.
Because I gave up everything. I gave up every, you know, sugar, alcohol, you know, anything with sugar in, gluten, soy. You know, the whole lot was gone from my diet.
Yeah.
And I kind of was really panicking quite a lot. And then it got to the point quite quickly that you go, well, this is what I eat.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is how I eat.
And then it becomes quite natural. Because even you go to a restaurant, you know, you pick, you know, it just sort of becomes an intuitive
thing. Do you want a good
tip
for a restaurant? I found this out recently.
Yeah.
If you tell them, so I always say I'm gluten-free because I am.
Yeah.
So they're now, they've got this big thing against allergies and, you know, they're going to get sued. So it's like, you can't have that. No, that's good. You can't have that. But if you tell them that you're diabetic, they have to tell you if there is any sugar in the meal at all. And I found this out on a Tinder date, actually.
Yeah,
and we went to this restaurant. He said, oh, I'm diabetic. And then after the waiter was gone, he went, I'm not. I just find out if there's sugar. I went, what a cool idea.
He
used to love Wagamamas. Yeah, you know, that was his favourite food.
Yeah.
And then he went in when he heard this tip and said, I'm diabetic. Nothing he could eat on the
menu.
Well,
yeah, no, I say, they bring the bread. I say, take it away. I don't want that because it will stare at you. You know,
it does look at you with that
and
look
I always
of
say,
love.
And I exactly, and I say, bring me some olives, because there's no glycemic load in olives. So you have a nice glass of wine, and by the way, a 125ml small glass of red wine a day decreases your risk of dementia, but more increases your risk. So nice glass of wine, not big one, small one. Olives, bring me some olives, even if it's not on the menu. Just bring me some olives. It always works.
They're always on the menu.
Get a starter. Get a main course and get the bill and then get the hell out of there, because there's no low sugar desserts, you know, it's just the way it is. But that's my little restaurant tip. But what I realized,
I only ever have one course, so I don't have nibbles.
No,
I don't, I literally have one course because I have really one meal a day, plus a smoothie or soup.
I love food.
I say to my children that I'm going to, I say, I do one pudding a year, Christmas Day, and then every Christmas Day goes by, and they went, you did it again, Mother, you didn't serve a pudding. I go, well, you couldn't eat a pudding after that veritable fest I've just put on the table, could you?
No. Well, I realise really there are two kinds of people. There are those who want to go for it, they want to transform their health, they want to do the things, they don't want to end up with dementia or cancer or heart disease or whatever, in which case, we've made it really easy. You just, you know, do the test, follow the instructions. And then there are those who just want to keep doing, you know, maybe too addicted or ignorant, but they just want to keep doing whatever it is that they do. And one day the shit will hit the fan, because it always does. And they go, oh, I've got diabetes. Oh, I've got cancer. Oh, I've got dementia. Doctor, you know.
Have you got a tablet?
Yeah. I mean, because I'm 60... six, they want to do all these tests, so they tested me, and you know, everything's
you
good.
Should be like me. I'm sick, I've just turned 60. I don't go near doctors.
No, I mean, generally not. And I know that they get their quaff points, so they get money if they do certain tests. But anyway, I'm in there, and you know, I got no high blood pressure, I've got no heart disease, I'm super fit. My blood fats, triglycerides are like really, really low.
Oh,
my,
you must really piss your
my
doctor
good
off.
Cholesterol HDL is really high. And years ago, they called it diagnostic creep. They dropped the desirable cholesterol level from 6 to 5.2.
They did, just as they brought statins out,
exactly.
Funnily enough.
Exactly, isn't it strange?
Isn't that strange?
So he says, you need to be on statins for the rest of your life.
And you went, I think not.
Well, I said, you know, do you know the NNT for statins for somebody with no former risk, you know, cardiovascular risk? NNT means numbers needed to treat for a benefit. And the answer is it's close to infinity. It just doesn't exist. He said, I can't possibly know the NNT for all the drugs I prescribe. I said, well, why not? That's your job. So I said, how on earth can you conclude that I need to be on a drug for the rest of my life when everything says zero risk? And he said, oh, yeah, in the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, nice. They have a little calculator where you put in your age, 66, you put in your cholesterol, and it says you need to be on statins, you know?
Yep.
And there isn't a single independent study, i.e. not funded by the drug company, that has shown this benefit of statins. Now, the point here, because we haven't even gone there, all the trials that are telling us these new anti-amyloid drugs do something, and we know that they're not clinically effective, they're all funded and totally controlled by the drug companies. There have been actually, I think, what is it, something like 25 or 30 trials, but when the researchers, I said that there were 15 trials that showed that they lowered amyloid but had no effect. There's actually a lot more, but they wouldn't give them the results. So the trials are owned and controlled, absolutely. The whole narrative is owned and controlled, absolutely. These apparent councils will invite only the people they wish to influence
on
the government. You know, they're spending your money. You know, they're spending our hard-earned cash that we pay in taxes to do things, to drive profit.
I know. And then they, you know, they lobby the governments to say, you know, we have to do this. And, you know, there's this crisis going on and we need more and more of your money to fund this. And
so the answer is wake up, become a citizen scientist, which is what you will be. Get out of that. We will generate big data, which whether it's under, it will be undeniable. But the point is, when we reach a million people, we're helping a million people. When I get pissed off, I usually write a song or a poem, and I wrote one that says, what's it all about, all these people checking out, years of memories erased, whole lives dematerialized, one-way ticket out of here, filled with anxiety and fear, the product of the human race, rich in wealth but lost in space, or a race for profit. What a disgrace. A race for profit. What a disgrace. And it is disgraceful.
It's criminal. It's not disgraceful. Yeah. It's criminal.
And we do not need, I mean, you do, something else. The average woman right now in the EU will spend 14 years of their life unable to climb 10 steps. That's the statistic. And you go, oh, that's terrible. I better do some exercise. I better keep my legs strong and so on. You never think it's not preventable. You know, you just think, obviously,
do something about
you know,
it.
In Okinawa, you know, you've got 100-year-olds doing Tai Chi and dancing and all the rest of it, right? That's exactly what's happening with our brains. You are the architect of your own brain's future.
You are of your whole body.
Yeah.
And I have a new catch line at the end of each show. I'm going to say it any moment, but Patrick, thank you so much. And I just pray that people share this with anybody you know. We all know somebody affected by at least one aspect of the things we've talked about today, you know, whether it's ADHD, whether it's dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's cancer, whether it's, you know, anything. As Patrick said, this affects the whole body. Go and get the book, Upgrade Your Brain.
And don't get it from Amazon, get it from foodforthebrain.org.
Got
because
that.
Then you're helping to fund all this science.
Brilliant. Get it from foodforthebrain.org. And remember, and this is the most important thing that you can remember in your life, the doctor of your future is you. Good luck. We've got this. We're going to get over all of this corruption and we're going to get ourselves healthy and fit and strong. Patrick Holford, thank you so much for coming on the show again.
My pleasure. Alzheimer's Prevention Day.
And we will prevent it.